pots and a cooler and made a place under a tree beyond the left field fence. Link found them immediately and took a seat on a quilt. He drank a pregame beer. Most of the players seemed to be enjoying a beverage, even on the field, and Jerry quizzed him about his future. His dream job was with the Department of Justice in Washington as a starter, then perhaps something in private practice. He was wary of the big firm grind and wanted to litigate civil rights for the disabled. His father had been injured on the job and was confined to a wheelchair. The more Jerry watched him around her daughter, the more convinced she became that Link was the future, and she was fine with that. He was engaging, smart, quick-witted, and obviously enamored with Denise. After he left to play, Denise said, "Okay, Mom, I want to know how you found this guy." "Which guy?" "The killer." Jerry smiled, shook her head, and finally said, "The whole story?" "Yes, I want to know."
"This might take some time."
"What else are we doing for the next few hours?" "Okay." 31. Late Saturday morning, Lacey and her boyfriend left Tallahassee for a 3-hour drive to Ocala, north of Orlando. Allie did the driving as Lacey handled the entertainment. They began with an audiobook by Elmore Leonard, but she soon decided she'd had enough of crime and dead bodies and switched to a podcast on politics. It, too, quickly became depressing, so she found NPR, and they laughed through an episode of "Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me." Their appointment with Herman Gray was at 2 p.m. Mr. Gray was an FBI legend who had overseen the Behavioral Analysis Unit at Quantico for 2 decades. Now pushing 80, he had retired to Florida and lived behind a gate with his wife and 3 dogs. Allie had been referred to him by a supervisor and had made the necessary calls. Herman said he was bored and had plenty of time, especially if the conversation was about serial killers. He had tracked and studied them throughout his career and, according to the legend, knew more about the breed than anyone. He had published 2 books on the subject, neither of which was particularly helpful. Both were more or less collections of his war stories, complete with gory photographs and a bit too much self-congratulation. He greeted them warmly and seemed genuinely pleased to have guests. His wife offered lunch, which they declined. She served them iced tea without sugar, and they talked for the first 30 minutes on the patio with the spaniels licking their ankles. When he began talking about his career, Lacey interrupted politely with, "We've read both of your books, so we know something about your work." He liked that and tried to defer with, "Most of that stuff is accurate. Maybe a bit of embellishment here and there." "It's fascinating," she said. Allie said, "As I explained on the phone, Lacey would like to walk through each of the victims and get your thoughts." "The afternoon belongs to you," Herman said with a smile. Lacey said, "It's extremely confidential and we won't use any real names." "I understand discretion, Ms. Stoltz. Believe me, I do." "Can we go with Lacey and Allie?" "Sure, and I'm Herman. I see you've brought a briefcase, so I assume there's paperwork, maybe some photos." "Yes." "Perhaps we should go to the kitchen and use the table?" They followed him inside, as did the dogs, and Mrs. Gray refilled their glasses. Herman sat on one side of the table and faced Lacey and Allie. She took a deep breath and began. "There are 8 murders that we know about. The first was in 1991, the most recent less than a year ago. The first 7 were by strangulation, same type of rope, same method, but for the last one, no rope was used, just a few blows to the head." 23 years. "Yes, sir."
Could we drop the sirs?
Yep. Thank you. I'll be 80 in 2 months, but I am refusing to let the old man in. Thin as a weed, he looked like he could walk 10 miles in the hot sun. Obviously, we believe our suspect killed all 8 people, 6 men, 2 women. There are probably more, you know. Yes, but we have no knowledge of them. Herman took out his pen and found a notepad. Let's talk about number 1. Allie opened the briefcase and handed Lacey a file. She said, number 1 was a 41-year-old white male, all but one were white, who was found beside a walking trail in Signal Mountain, Tennessee. She handed Herman a sheet of paper she had prepared with the words number 1 typed in bold letters at the top. Date, place, age of victim, cause of death, and a color photo of Thad Leawood lying in the bushes. Herman studied the summary and the photo and took notes. They watched him carefully and said nothing. When he had reviewed it, he asked, other than the body, was there anything from the crime scene? The police found nothing. No prints, fibers, hair, no blood other than the victim's. Same for all the crime scenes. A strange knot, something like a clove hitch. A double clove hitch, not very common. Rare indeed. If he used it every time, then it's obviously his calling card. How many blows to the head? 2, with what appears to be the same weapon. Autopsy? The skull splintered, numerous cracks radiating from the contact point. The police in Wilmington, North Carolina, at another crime scene, thought it was something like a hammer or small round metal ball. Works every time, though it does make a messy scene. The blood spatters to such a degree that the suspect probably had some on his clothing, which, of course, was never found. Of course not. Motive? The theory is that number 1 sexually abused the killer when he was a young boy. That's a lot of motive. Any proof of this? Not really. Okay, how about number 2? Lacey handed him the sheet for Brian Burke and said, the following year, 1992. Herman looked at it and said, South Carolina. Yes, each was in a different state. He smiled and made notes. Motive? Their paths crossed in college when the killer was a student. Number 2 was one of his professors. Lacey was careful not to use the words law school. That would come later. Allie had not told Herman much about her and had not revealed where she worked or who she investigated. Again, that would be discussed later in the afternoon. Number 3 was Ashley Barrasso. Lacey said, 4 years later in Columbus, Georgia. We know nothing of motive, only that they were in school together. College? Yes. Was she sexually abused in any way? Nope. She was fully clothed, nothing was disturbed, no sign of molestation. That's unusual. Sex is a factor in about 80% of serial crimes. Number 4 was Eileen Nickelberry in 1998. With number 5, Danny Cleveland, Lacey said, our man took a break for 11 years, at least as far as we know. That's quite a gap, Herman said, studying the photo. Same knot. He doesn't want to get caught, too smart for that. But he wants someone to know that he's out there. Not at all uncommon. He scribbled more notes as his wife appeared and offered them cookies. She did not stay in the kitchen, but Lacey got the impression she was close by, probably listening. Number 6 was Perry Kroenke down in Marathon. Herman studied the photos and asked, where did you get these? They were given to us by a source who's been working on this for many years. Freedom of Information Act, FBI clearinghouse, the usual. We have photos from the first 6 crime scenes, but not the last. Too recent, I suppose. Poor guy was out fishing, just minding his own business, in broad daylight. I've been to the scene and it was pretty remote. Okay, motive? They crossed paths in the workplace. Probably a disagreement over a job offer that didn't materialize. So he knew him too? He knew all of them. Herman just thought he'd seen it all and was visibly impressed. Okay, let's see the last one. Lacey handed over number 7 and number 8 and explained their theory that the first victim was the target and the second arrived on the scene at the wrong time. Herman studied the summaries and photos for a long time, then said with a grin, "Well, is that all?" "That's all we know about." "You can bet there's more, and you can bet he's not finished." They nodded, and both took a bite of cookie. Herman said, "So now you want a profile, right?" Allie said, "Sure, that's one reason we're here." Herman put down his pen, stood and stretched his back, and scratched his chin as he thought. "White male, age 50, started his mischief when he was mid-20s, single, probably never married. Except for the first two, he kills on Fridays and weekends, clear indication that he has an important job. You mentioned college? And it's obvious he's bright, even brilliant, and patient. No sex angle, so he's probably impotent. You know the motive, driven by a sick need for revenge. Kills without remorse, which is usually the case, sociopathic to say the least, antisocial, but being educated, probably manages to put up a front and maintain what appears to be a normal life. 7 crime scenes in 7 states over a 23-year period. Very unusual. He knows the police won't dig deep enough to link the crimes. And the FBI is not involved? Not yet, Allie said. That's another reason we're here. He knows forensics, police procedure, and the law, Lacey said. Herman slowly sat down and looked at his notes. Quite unusual, even unique. I'm impressed with this guy. What do you know about him? Lacey said, "Well, he certainly fits your profile. He's a judge." Herman exhaled as if somewhat overwhelmed. He shook his head and thought for a long time. Finally, he said, "A sitting judge? Duly elected by the voters. Wow. Quite unusual. Narcissistic, split personality, able to live in one world as a respected, productive member of society while spending his off hours plotting the next kill. It'll be hard to nail this guy. Unless," Allie said, "unless he makes a mistake, right?" "Right," Lacey said. "We think he's made one. At his last stop, you asked about the FBI. They're not involved in the investigation, but they have found a clue. He left a partial thumbprint on a cell phone. The lab in Quantico has spent months with it, run all the tests. The problem is, there is no match anywhere. The FBI thinks he's probably altered his prints." Herman shook his head in disbelief. "Well, I'm not a print guy. But I know that's virtually impossible without extensive surgery." Lacey said, "He can afford it, and he's had plenty of time." Allie said, "I've checked around, talked to some of our experts. There have been a handful of cases where the prints were altered." "If you say so, I have my doubts." Lacey said, "So do we. If we can't get a match, then the case looks hopeless. There's no other proof other than motive, and that's not enough, right?" "I don't know. I suppose there's no way to get his prints, his current ones?" "Not without a warrant," Lacey said. "We have suspicion, but that's not enough to convince a judge to issue one. We need advice, Herman, Allie said. What's our next step? Where does the guy live?
Pensacola.
And the print is in Mississippi, right?
Correct.
Will the authorities there call in the bureau?
I'm sure they will. They're desperate to solve the murders.
Then you have to start there. Once our boys are involved, it'll be easier to convince a federal magistrate to issue a search warrant.
And search what? Lacey asked.
His home, his office, any place there might be prints.
Allie said, there might be a couple of problems with that.
The first is that this guy is capable of leaving no prints anywhere. The second is that he might disappear at the first whiff of trouble.
Let our boys worry about the prints. They'll find them.
No one is capable of wiping clean their home or office. As for the disappearing act, that's a chance you take. You can't arrest him until there is a match with the prints, right? No other proof?
So far, none, Lacey said.
There might be another problem, Allie said. Is there a chance the Bureau will decline to get involved?
Why?
The slim chance of success. The first six crime scenes yielded zero evidence. Those cases are ice cold and have been for years. You know the politics at Quantico. And you know how perpetually understaffed the BAU is. Is it possible they could take a hard look at this and pass?
Herman waved off the idea. No, I don't see it. We've tracked serial killers for years and never found them. Some of the cases I worked on 30 years ago are still unsolved, always will be. That will not deter the BAU. This is their meat and potatoes. And keep in mind, they don't have to solve all of the murders. You just need one to put this guy away.
Herman put down his pen and folded his arms across his chest. You have no choice but to bring in the Bureau.
I sense some hesitation.
Lacey told the story of Betty Rowe and her 20-year quest to find her father's murderer. Herman interrupted with, Is she looking for a job? I think the Bureau needs her.
She has a career, Lacey said after a laugh. She filed a complaint with the Board on Judicial Conduct. That's where I work. She's very fragile and frightened, and I promised we would not bring in the police until we finished our initial investigation.
Herman didn't like this and said,
Too bad. She's no longer a factor. You have a very sophisticated killer still at work, and it's time to bring in the Bureau. The longer you wait, the more bodies they'll find. This guy will not stop.
32. On Tuesday, the Pensacola Ledger ran a brief story on page 5 of its news section. Mal Schnetzer, a local lawyer from years past, had been murdered the previous Saturday in a trailer in Sugarland, Texas, west of Houston, where he had been living. The police gave the barest of details, saying only that he had been strangled in a trailer rented by a person who had yet to be found. The story recalled his days as a well-known plaintiff's lawyer in the Panhandle, before he was disbarred and sent to prison for robbing his clients. There was a small photo of Mal in his better days. Jerry saw the story online and read it with her morning coffee. She immediately pulled together the other stories. Danny Cleveland, the former Ledger reporter who had been strangled in his apartment in Little Rock in 2009. Thad Leawood, strangled in 1991 near Signal Mountain, Tennessee. And Lanny Verno, murdered in Biloxi the previous year. Schnetzer, Cleveland, and Leawood had been known in Pensacola, and the Ledger reported their deaths. Verno had been passing through and was not known, thus, there was no local coverage. She found the stories of the murders from the local newspapers in Little Rock, Chattanooga, Houston, and Biloxi,
and arranged them all neatly in a file that she sent through a new email account to a reporter named Kemper, the woman who had written about the Schnetzer murder. She attached a cryptic note. 4 unsolved strangulations of people with close ties to Pensacola. Verno lived here in 2001. Do your homework. She had not heard of the Schnetzer murder and wasn't about to start digging. She was exhausted and virtually broke and simply couldn't muster the energy for another investigation. As always, she suspected Bannock, but someone else would have to worry about the case. The following morning, on the front page beneath the fold, was a sensational story about the 4 Pensacola men who had been murdered in other states. The local police wouldn't comment and deflected all questions because they knew nothing. The killings were not in their jurisdiction. Likewise, the state police wouldn't comment. Jerry read it gleefully and immediately sent it, encrypted, as always, to Lacey Stoltz. Minutes later, she texted her the encryption key. Lacey was at her desk reading assessments of other complaints when she saw the email and opened the file. There was no message. Who else would send her a private email and then the key? Who else would have the old stories from the Ledger and the other newspapers? Once again, she marveled at Jerry's research and tenaciousness and managed to chuckle at Herman Gray's comment about her being needed by the FBI. She closed her door and for a long time reread the reports of the old murders and the new ones. She tried to gauge the impact of the morning story and finally concluded there was no way to predict what might happen. There was little doubt, though, that it would change the landscape. Bannock would see it, probably already had. Who in the world could guess his next move? Judge Bannock was in a hotel room in Santa Fe when he saw it. As always, he scanned the Ledger online for all the news from home, and when he saw it, he began cursing. The only other person who could possibly link Lanny Verno to Pensacola was Jerry Burke. Maybe the ex-cop, Norris Osment, but he was not in the loop. A few of the older lawyers could link him to Schnetzer and their fee dispute back in 1993. Perhaps a reporter at the Ledger might remember Danny Cleveland and his muckraking article about Bannock when he first ran for office, though this was doubtful. Cleveland had gone after several shady developers. No one, to his knowledge, was still around to link him to Thad Leawood. There had been no criminal charges, and the frightened victims hid behind their parents, who had no idea what to do. He was 13 years old and had achieved the rank life, with 18 merit badges, including all the required ones. His goal was to make Eagle by his 14th birthday, something his father encouraged because after that, the high school years arrived and scouting would become less important. He led the Shark Patrol, the finest in the troop. He loved every part of it. The weekends in the woods, the training for the mile swim, the jamborees, the challenge of making Eagle, the search for more merit badges, the award ceremonies, the community service. After the assault, he missed a meeting, something that never happened. When he missed the second one, his parents were curious. He could not carry the burden alone, and so he told them. They were horrified and devastated and had no clue about where to go for help. His father finally met with the police and was distressed to learn that there had been another complaint from a boy unwilling to be identified. He suspected it was Jason Wright, a friend who had abruptly quit the troop 2 months earlier. The police wanted to meet with Ross, but the idea terrified him. He was sleeping at the foot of his parents' bed and hated to leave the house. They decided that protecting their child was more important than demanding punishment. The nightmare went from bad to worse when the Ledger ran a story about a police investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct by Thad Leawood, age 28. It was obviously leaked by the police, in Dr. Bannock's opinion, and sent the town into orbit. Leawood slinked away and was not seen again. 14 years passed before he paid for his crimes. Late Wednesday afternoon, Lacey was out of excuses and weary of procrastinating. She closed and locked her office door and called the first of several phone numbers for Betty Rowe. None were answered, which was not unusual. Minutes later, her smartphone pinged with a text from an unknown number. Betty wrote, "Go to the green line, code for use your burner." Lacey picked up her disposable phone and waited another minute for the call. Betty began cheerfully with, "How about that story in the Ledger?" "Interesting, to say the least. I wonder how they put all the murders together so fast." "Oh, I don't know. I'm sure it was an anonymous email from someone who's familiar with the murders, wouldn't you say?" "I would indeed. I wonder how our boy reacted." "I'm sure it ruined his day. I hope he had a massive stroke and gagged to death on his vomit. They say he's in bad health anyway. Rumor of colon cancer, but I doubt it. More like a good reason to get out of town." "You sound feisty." "I'm in pretty good spirits, Lacey. I went to Michigan and spent last weekend with my daughter. Had a great visit." "Good, because I have some news that you may not want." "We've finished our assessment of your complaint, and we believe it has merit. We are referring it to the state police and the FBI. Our decision is final." Silence on the other end. Lacey plowed on. "You shouldn't be surprised, Betty. This is what you've always wanted. You used us to start the investigation and give it credibility while you hid in the dark. Nothing wrong with that, and I assure you, your name has not been used. We will continue to protect your identity to the extent possible." "What does that mean, to the extent possible?" "It means I'm not sure how the investigation will go. I don't know if the FBI will want your input, but if they do, I'm sure they know how to protect a key witness." "I won't sleep until he's arrested and locked up. You should be worried too, Lacey. I've warned you about this." "You have. And I'm being careful. He's smarter than we are, Lacey, and he's always watching." "You think he knows about our involvement?" "Assume he does, okay? Just assume the worst." "He's back there, Lacey." Lacey closed her eyes and was ready to end the call. Betty's paranoia was at times irksome. 33. The computer and phone networks of the Harrison County Sheriff's Department had been turned over to Nick Constantine, a 20-year-old part-time student at a community college down the road. He enjoyed the work and loved hanging around the deputies and other law enforcement types, most of whom needed plenty of help with technology. He had serious talent for it and could design and fix anything. He was constantly urging them to upgrade here and there, but there were always budget problems. Nick knew the Verno Dunwoody case was top secret. The vultures from the press were still circling, and Sheriff Black had put a lid on all communications, most of which were kept offline. To his great delight, Nick had been at the murder scene, and later led the sheriff and Deputy Mancuso to the two cell phones in the tiny town of Neely, Mississippi. An easy job any 12-year-old could handle. Nick routinely swept the network for viruses, but had been unable to detect Rafe and his evil pals from Maggots. They were dormant for the vast majority of the time. The mistake was made by Detective Napier, who sent a naked email to the sheriff confirming a meeting with the FBI on Friday, April 25th at the Bureau's office in Pensacola. Napier referred to the FBI as Hoovies, said a team from Washington would fly in with an expert, the cell phone, and the PTP. Napier immediately realized his mistake, deleted the email, found Nick, and asked him to wipe it clean from the network. He tracked it through the department's internal server and was confident everything had been erased. Napier and Nick then found the sheriff and explained what had happened. Nick dreamed of working for the FBI and was thrilled at the news of the meeting. He offered to be there, with the warning that he might be needed in case of more mistakes. Sheriff Black was not impressed. Rafe, dormant but ever present, saw the email. 30 minutes later, Judge Bannock saw it too and was stricken with panic. He knew how much the FBI loved acronyms. He knew the lingo as well as the agents in the field, PTP, partial thumbprint. Quickly, he checked the surveillance cameras and security systems at his home, courthouse office, and vault. There had been no entries. He booked the earliest flight out of Santa Fe, checked out of his hotel room, and headed home. The trip was interminable, but gave him plenty of time to think. He was certain he had left no prints behind. But what if he had? Any print taken from one of the cell phones would never find a match these days. After years of altering, the only match would have to be from a current print, something he had touched in the last decade. He arrived home at 3 a.m. and needed rest, but the Bennies were working too well. He kept the overhead lights off so the neighbors wouldn't know he was home and worked in the semi-darkness. He put on plastic gloves and filled the dishwasher with the first load. Some of the cups and glasses went into a large garbage liner. Wiping almost any surface at least smears the latent prints and renders them useless. Smearing, though, was not the plan. He mixed a solution of water, distilled alcohol, and lemon juice, and wiped the counters and appliances with a microfiber cloth. Light switches, walls, pantry shelves. From the refrigerator, he removed jars, cans, bottles, and plastic wrappers, and dumped the contents into the disposal. The containers went into the garbage sack. He didn't cook much, and the fridge was never full. Latent prints can last for years. As he cursed to himself, he kept mumbling, PTP. In the bathroom, he scrubbed the surfaces, walls, toilet, shower knobs, and floor. He emptied the cabinet, leaving behind only a toothbrush, a disposable razor, shaving cream, and a half-empty tube of Colgate. Prints were virtually impossible to lift from cloth, but he filled the washing machine anyway with bath and hand towels. In the den, he threw away the TV remote and wiped the LED screen. He threw away all magazines and a couple of old newspapers. He scrubbed the walls and the leather chairs. In his office, he wiped the keyboard, an old laptop, 2 outdated cell phones, and a pile of stationery and envelopes. He stared at a cabinet filled with files and decided to get them later. The cleansing would take hours, if not days, and he knew this was only the first pass-through. There would be a second, hopefully a third. At dawn, before the neighbors began moving about, he hauled 3 large black garbage liners to his SUV and sat down for a nap. Sleep was impossible. At 8,
he showered and changed, throwing away the towels and clothes. He stared into his closet and realized how much stuff had to be tossed. He filled the washing machine with underwear and clothing and doubled the detergent. He dressed casually and left. He called Diana Zhang, said he was back in town, felt good, and wanted to run by the courthouse to say hello. When he arrived at 9, his staff greeted him like a returning hero. He chatted with them for a while, assuring them that his first round of chemo had gone well and his doctors were encouraged. He would be home for a few days before heading back to Santa Fe. They thought he looked tired, even haggard. He sat at his desk and dictated to his secretary a list of things to do. He needed to make some calls and asked her to leave. He locked the door and looked around his office. The desk, leather chairs, work table, file cabinets, shelves lined with books and treatises. Thankfully, he hadn't touched most of them in years. The task seemed impossible, but he had no choice. He opened his briefcase, put on plastic gloves, removed 3 packs of alcohol wipes, and went to work. After 2 hours, he told his staff he was going home to rest. Please don't call. He drove instead to his hidden office in Pensacola. He doubted anyone sniffing for fingerprints would ever find the place, but he could take no chances. He had designed it with extreme caution. Careful to leave no clues in case of an emergency, everything was digitized. No books, files, bills, nothing to leave a trail. He stretched out on the sofa and managed to sleep for 2 hours. According to Jerry's class schedule, posted officially online, she taught a class in comparative politics at 2 p.m. in the Humanities Building. He drove an hour to Mobile and found the building from a campus map he had memorized. Her car, a white 2009 Toyota Camry, was parked with 100 others in a lot for faculty and students. Authorized stickers required. He left, drove to a car wash several blocks away, ran his new Tahoe through the self-wash, then parked by the vacuums and opened all 4 doors. As he toiled away, he swapped license plates and was now registered in Alabama. When things were shiny and spotless, he drove back to the Humanities Building and found a spot as close to the Camry as possible. He popped the hatch on his Tahoe, removed the jack and spare, and got busy pretending to change a rear tire that wasn't flat. A campus security guard in an old Bronco eased between the row of parked cars and stopped behind the Tahoe. "Need a hand?" he asked helpfully without making a move to get out. "No thanks," Bannock said. "I got it." "I don't see a parking sticker." "No, sir, had a flat out there," he said, nodding to the street. "I'll be gone in a minute." Guard drove away without a word. Shit. A mistake that couldn't be avoided. With the Tahoe jacked up and without touching a lug nut, he removed a Blue Cloud TS-180 GPS tracker with a magnetic mount. It weighed 14 ounces and was about the size of a thick paperback. He walked nonchalantly to the Camry, watching anything that moved from behind his sunglasses, noticed 3 students entering the building, but certainly not concerned with him, then quickly ducked and stuck the device to the side of the gas tank. Its battery lasted 180 hours and was motion activated. Thus, it took a nap when the car wasn't moving. He walked back to his Tahoe, jacked it down, put away the spare and the jack, closed the hatch and left the parking lot. The security guard was nowhere to be seen. 2 hours later, the Camry began moving. He tracked it with his smartphone and soon had it in sight. Jerry stopped at a dry cleaner's, did her business, then drove to her condo. The tracker worked beautifully. He returned to Cullman, waited until 5:30 when the courthouse was closed, and entered through a rear door with his own key. He had been coming and going as he pleased for 10 years and rarely saw anyone after hours. He was committing no crime, just tidying up his office. He wiped it again and left after dark with two thick briefcases filled with files and notepads. A hardworking judge. 34. On Friday morning, Lacey and Darren arrived at a downtown office building at 9:45 for a 10 o'clock meeting, a summit of sorts. The FBI office was on the 6th floor, and they were met at the elevator there by Special Agent Dagner of Pensacola. From a third-story hotel room 2 blocks away, Judge Bannock monitored the parking lot through a handheld monocular telescope. He watched Lacey and Darren disappear into the building. 10 minutes later, he saw an unmarked sedan with Mississippi tags park and two men get out. They were in street clothes, even wearing coats and ties for the big meeting. Next was a black SUV. All 4 doors opened at the same time, and the feds, 3 men and 1 woman, in nicer dark suits, spilled out and hustled inside. The last two arrived in a car with Florida license plates. More dark suits. When the traffic stopped at 10 after 10, Bannock sat on the edge of the bed and rubbed his temples. The FBI had arrived. The Hoovies from the big office in Washington, along with the state police and the boys from Mississippi. He could not know what was being said over there. Rafe had failed to penetrate the network, but the judge had a pretty good idea of what was going on, and he knew how to find out. They gathered around a long table in the suite's largest room, while 2 secretaries brought in coffee and pastries. After a round of introductions, so many names that Darren tried to write them all down, the boss called the meeting to order. He was Clay Vidovich, the special agent in charge, SAC, and he assumed the chair at the head of the table. To his right were special agents Suarez, Neff, and Murray. To his left were Sheriff Dale Black and Detective Napier from Biloxi. Next to them were 2 investigators from the Florida State Police, Harris and Wendell. Lacey and Darren sat at the far end of the table, as if they really didn't belong with the real cops. Noticeably absent were the Pensacola police. The suspect was a local guy with plenty of contacts. Loose lips sink ships and all that. The city boys would only get in the way. Vidovich began with, "Now, the paperwork has been completed. All protocols have been cleared, and the FBI is officially engaged in this case. This is now a joint task force with all of us cooperating fully. Sheriff, what about the Mississippi State Police?" "Well, they've certainly been kept up to date, but I was asked to not mention this initial meeting. I assume they're ready if we need them." "Not now, maybe later. Lieutenant Harris, have you notified the police down in Marathon?"
"No, sir, but I will if we need them."
"Good. Let's proceed without them. Now, we've all read the summaries, and I think we're up to speed. Ms. Stultz, since you got all this started, why don't you take a few minutes and go over the basics?"
"Sure," she said, flashing a smile. The only other woman in the room was Agent Agnes Neff, a tough-looking veteran who had yet to smile. Lacey stood and pushed back her chair. "This began with a complaint against Judge Bannock, filed by one Betty Rowe, an alias.
When do we get her real name?
Well, it's now your case, so I guess anytime you want. But I prefer to keep her out of it as long as possible.
Very well. And why is she involved?
Her father was murdered in 1992 near Gaffney, South Carolina. The case went cold almost immediately, and she became determined to find his killer. She's been obsessed with the case for years.
And we're talking about 8 murders, right?
8 that she knows of. There could be more.
I think we can assume there are more.
And all she has is motive, right?
And method.
Vidovich looked at Suarez, who shook his head and said, "It's the same guy. Same type of rope, and the knot is his trademark. We got the crime scene photos from Schnetzer in Texas, same rope and knot. We've studied the autopsies, same type of blow to the head, same instrument. Something like a claw hammer that shatters the skull in one defined point of impact and radiates rupture lines in all directions."
Vidovich looked at Lieutenant Harris and asked, "And the killer knew him in another life, right?"
Harris said, "That's right. They were both lawyers here in town many years ago."
"And you don't know this judge, right, Ms. Stoltz?"
"No, I've not had the pleasure. He's never had a complaint filed against him. A clean record and a good reputation."
"This is remarkable,"
Vidovich said to the table, and everyone frowned in agreement. He continued, "Ms. Stoltz, what do you think he would do if we simply asked him to stop by for a few questions? He is a well-known judge, an officer of the court. He doesn't know about the PTP. Why wouldn't he want to cooperate?"
"Well, if he's guilty, why would he cooperate?
In my opinion, he would either disappear or lawyer up, but he will not make himself available."
"And he's a flight risk?"
"Yes, in my opinion, he's smart and he has assets. He's done a superb job of avoiding detection for the past 20 years. I think this guy could vanish in a split second."
"Thank you."
Lacey sat down and looked at the faces around the table. Vidovich said, "It's obvious that we need his prints, his current ones. Agnes, talk to us about a search warrant."
Still unsmiling, she cleared her throat and looked at her notepad.
"I met with legal yesterday in Washington, and they think we can do it. A prime suspect in a murder, 2 of them actually, the Biloxi case, and a mysterious partial print there that matches nothing. Legal says we can push hard for a warrant. The U.S. attorney in Mississippi has been briefed and has a magistrate on standby."
Lacey said, "May I ask what you plan to search?"
"His home and office," Vidovich said. "They're covered with his prints. We get a match, game over. No match, and we apologize and leave town. Betty Rowe can go back to her Sherlock Holmes routine."
"Okay, but he's a fanatic about security and surveillance. He'll know the instant someone kicks in a door or somehow gets inside. Then he's gone."
"Do we know where he is at this moment?"
A unified shaking of heads.
Vidovich glared at Harris, who said,
"No, we haven't been watching him. No reason to. There's no case, no file. He's not a suspect yet."
Lacey said, "He's also on leave for medical reasons. Claims he's in treatment for cancer, according to a source we have here in Pensacola. His office told one of our contacts that he would not sit on the bench for at least the next 2 months. The district court's webpage confirms this."
Vidovich frowned and rubbed his jaw as everyone else waited. He said,
"Okay, let's start with surveillance and find the guy. In the meantime, let's get a search warrant from the magistrate in Mississippi. Bring it to the magistrate here and sit on it until we find him. At that time, he can't disappear and we'll execute the warrant." They discussed surveillance for an hour. Who, where, how. Lacey and Darren grew bored. Their initial excitement dissipated, and they finally asked to be excused. Vidovich promised to keep them in the loop
but it was obvious their work was over. Leaving town, Darren asked,
"Are you going to report this to Betty?"
"No, she doesn't need to know what's going on. Are we done with her? Can we close the case?"
"I'm not sure."
"Well, aren't you the boss?"
"Certainly."
"Then why can't you say that BJC is no longer involved?"
"Tired of it?"
"We're lawyers, Lacey, not cops."
The 3-hour drive back to Tallahassee was a relief. It was almost noon on a Friday, on an oddly cool spring day, and they decided to forget about the office. As they discussed his fate, Judge Bannock drove 10 minutes to his shopping center and disappeared into his other chamber and his vault. He wiped his computers clean, removed the hard drives, gathered the thumb drives from the hidden safes, and scrubbed the place again. Leaving, he reset the security cameras and sensors and left for Mobile. He spent the afternoon roaming a mall, drinking espressos in a Starbucks, drinking club soda in a dark bar, loitering along the harbor, and driving around until dark. 35. The plain, white, legal-size envelope contained copies of her 3 little poems. It was sealed and addressed in heavy black ink, Jerry Crosby. No postal address was given, but then none was needed. The words hand-delivered were scrawled under her name. He waited until 9 p.m. and parked at the curb 2 short blocks away. Jerry was idling away another Friday night, flipping stations on TV and resisting the temptation to go online and look for more murders. Lacey had called after lunch with the news that the FBI was in town and assuming control of the investigation. Jerry should be in a better mood now that her work was over and Bannock was being pursued by the pros. She was learning, though, that obsessions die hard, and it was impossible to simply flip a switch and move on. She had lived in his life for so long, she couldn't force him out of her being. She had no other purpose other than her neglected work and her lovely daughter, and she was terrified still. She asked herself how long the fear would last. Would she ever go a full hour without glancing over her shoulder? The doorbell jolted her. She fumbled with the remote, got the TV muted, grabbed the nearest pistol from a table by the door, and peeked through the blinds. A street lamp lit the front lawns of the 4 condos in her row and revealed nothing. She wasn't about to open the door, not at 9 p.m. on a Friday night, and could think of no one who would be stopping by without calling first. Not even the political candidates worked such hours. She waited for it to ring again, gripping her pistol and resisting the urge to look into the peephole. Long minutes passed, and the fact that whoever was out there did not ring again and did not really want to see her made the situation worse. Could it be some kids pulling pranks? That had never happened before, not on her quiet little street. She realized she was sweating and her stomach was in knots. She tried to breathe deeply, but her heart was racing. Slowly, she stepped to the door and said loud enough to be heard on the stoop, "Who is it?" Of course, there was no answer. She found the courage to look through the peephole, half expecting to see some bloodshot eyeball leering back at her, but there was nothing. She took a step back, breathed deep again, kept the pistol in her right hand, and unlocked the deadbolt with her left. With the chain latched, she looked out through the storm door but saw no one. Was she hearing things again?
Had the doorbell really been punched by someone?
The camera, you idiot.
Her doorbell was used so infrequently, she forgot about the camera. She walked to the kitchen, picked up her smartphone, and with badly shaking hands, managed to find the app. She gawked at the video. The doorbell camera was motion activated, and from 5 feet away, as the person seemed to come out of the bushes, the video began. He bounded up the stoop, stuck an envelope in the storm door, and disappeared. She watched it again and again and felt sick to her stomach. Male, with long sandy hair that touched his shoulders, a cap with no logo pulled low, thick framed glasses, and under them was a skin-colored mask with pockmarks and scars, something from a horror film. She turned on lights and sat on the sofa with her gun and phone. She watched the video again. It ran for 6 seconds, though he was visible for only half of it. 3 seconds were enough. She caught herself crying, something she hated, but the tears had nothing to do with sorrow. They were tears of sheer terror. Her stomach flipped, and she wanted to throw up. Her body shook to her toes as her heart raced away. And matters would soon get worse. Eventually, she forced herself to stand and walk to the door. She unlocked and cracked it again, then unlocked the storm door. The envelope fell to the threshold. She grabbed it, relocked everything, and returned to the sofa where she stared at it for 10 minutes. When she opened it and saw her silly poems, her hand instinctively flew up to her mouth and muffled her scream. The police were irritated by such a frivolous call. It took them 20 minutes to arrive, thankfully without the benefit of all those blue lights, and she met them on the stoop. "A prowler?" the first one asked. For her benefit, the second one poked around the flower bed with a flashlight, seeing nothing. Jerry showed them the video. "It's just a prank, ma'am," the first one said, shaking his head at such a nuisance. "Somebody just trying to scare the hell out of you." It was Friday night in a big city, and they had far more pressing matters with violent crimes, drug dealers, and drunk teenagers. "Well, the prank certainly worked," she said. Mr. Brammer from next door walked over and the cops quizzed him. Jerry hadn't spoken to him in weeks, same for all of her neighbors. She was known as a recluse and not that friendly. He told her to call if it happened again. The police were ready to leave and promised to patrol the area for the next few hours. After they were gone, she refortified her condo and sat on the sofa, all lights on, thinking the unthinkable. Panic knew it was her. He had been to her house, rang her doorbell, left behind her poems, and he would be back. She thought about calling Denise, but why frighten her? She was 1,000 miles away and could do nothing to help. She thought about calling Lacey, just so someone would know, but she was 3 hours away and probably wouldn't take the call at such an hour. At midnight, she turned off all the lights and sat in the dark, waiting. An hour later, she packed a small bag and, pistol in hand, left through her back door and got in the car. She drove away, eyes glued to the rearview mirror, and saw nothing suspicious. She zigzagged through quiet neighborhoods, turned east on Interstate 10, and when the downtown lights were behind her, she relaxed, relieved to be out of the city. She took an exit and went south toward the Gulf on Highway 59. The road was deserted at that hour, and she was certain no one was following. Through the towns of Robertsdale and Foley, she parked at an all-night convenience store and watched the road behind her. A car passed every 10 minutes. The highway stopped at the beach in Gulf Shores. East or west were the choices. Bannock was probably still lurking around Mobile, so she turned left and drove through the beachside towns in Alabama, then crossed into Florida. For an hour, she drifted along Highway 98 until a traffic light stopped her in Fort Walton Beach. A car had been behind her for a few miles, and it was odd because there was virtually no other traffic. On a whim, she turned north on Highway 85, but the car did not follow. Half an hour later, she crossed Interstate 10 and saw signs for fast food, gas, and lodging. She needed to rest and was attracted to the bright lights and half-empty parking lot of the Bayview Motel. She parked, put her pistol in her bag, and went in to get a room. 20 minutes later, Bannock turned into the parking lot. He sat with his laptop in his SUV, again with Alabama tags, and reserved a room online. When the confirmation email landed, he waited 10 minutes and replied that there had been a problem with the reservation. "Please look at his attachment." When the clerk did so, Rafe eased through the rather lame security system and began fishing around the network. Since 9:28 the previous evening, only one guest had checked in, a Margie Fraser, who evidently used a prepaid credit card. "How cute," thought the judge. "She likes to use different names." Rafe found her in room 232. Across the hall, 233 appeared to be vacant. Down the hall was an exit door and stairwell for emergencies only. The motel used a typical electronic keycard system with a master switch for fire evacuations. Rafe found the lighting smart panel, and for fun, the judge flipped off the lights in the lobby, left the place in the dark for a few seconds, then turned them back on. Not a soul was stirring. He entered the empty lobby and tapped the bell at the reception desk. Eventually, a sleepy-eyed young man appeared and said hello. They went through the quick paperwork for a single, for one night only, with the judge chatting away. He asked for room 233, said he stayed in it 6 months earlier and slept for 9 hours, a recent record, wanted to try his luck again. Superstition and all that. The kid didn't care. He took the elevator to the second floor, eased into room 233 without a sound, and inspected the door. For added security, it had the square bar lock as well as the electronic deadbolt. Nothing fancy, but then it was a tourist motel renting rooms for $99 a night. He pulled on a pair of flesh-colored plastic gloves, opened his laptop, hooked up with Rafe, and looked at the security and lighting systems. Margie was across the hall in 232. Next door, 234 was vacant. For practice, he instructed Rafe to unlock all room doors, then he stepped over to 234 and opened it by simply turning the knob. Back in his room, he relocked all the doors, then arranged his tools on the cheap credenza, carefully laying out a small bottle of ether, a microfiber cloth, a small flashlight, and a latch bypass blade. He put these in the front pockets of a vest he'd worn on several of these special occasions. Beside the tool bag, he gently arranged a hypodermic needle and a small bottle of ketamine, a strong barbiturate used for anesthesia. He stretched his back, took some deep breaths, and reminded himself of two important truths. First, he had no choice. Second, failure was not an option. It was 18 minutes past 3 a.m., Saturday, April 26th. With his laptop, he instructed Rafe to first unlock all doors, then kill the electricity. everything was instantly black. With the flashlight between his teeth, he opened his door, stepped across the hall, quietly turned the knob to 232, slid the latch bypass blade through the crack, pushed back the square bar lock, opened the door 2 feet wide, got on his knees, turned off the flashlight, and crawled into the room. As far as he knew, at that moment, he had not made a sound. She was sleeping. He listened to her heavy breathing, smiled, and knew that the rest would be easy. Feeling his way, he inched beside her bed, removed a microfiber cloth soaked with ether from his vest pocket, clicked on the flashlight, and attacked. Jerry was sleeping on her side under the sheets and knew nothing was wrong until a heavy hand slapped her mouth and pressed so hard she couldn't breathe. Groggy, bewildered, terrified, she tried to wiggle free, but her assailant was strong and had every advantage. The last thing she remembered was the sweet taste of something on a cloth pad. He checked the hallway. Pitch blackness, no voices anywhere. He dragged her into his room and situated her on the bed, then went to the laptop and turned on the electricity. He had never seen her before. Average height, slender, sort of pretty, though hard to tell with her eyes closed. She had gone to bed in black yoga pants and a faded blue t-shirt, probably ready to run again at a moment's notice. He drew 500 milligrams of ketamine and shot her in her left arm. The drug should keep her out for 3 to 4 hours. He hurried back to her room, got her sneakers and a light jacket, noticed the pistol on the nightstand, a 9mm automatic. For a split second, considered himself lucky she didn't use it, left the room and closed the door. His SUV was parked as close to the exterior stairwell as possible. He tossed his bag inside, opened the hatch, looked around the parking lot and saw nothing, then returned to his room. He went to his laptop, switched off the electricity, double-checked to make sure all security cameras were off, then lifted Jerry from the bed, flung her over his shoulder, grunted, and hurried down the hallway and down the stairs. He stopped at the edge of the building for another look, again saw nothing moving, no headlights anywhere, and hurried through the dark shadows to his SUV. Breathing heavily now and sweating, he returned to his room to gather his laptop, her sneakers and jacket, and to make sure nothing was left behind. At 3:38, he left the parking lot of the Bayview Motel and headed east along the coast. 36. She awoke in complete blackness with a heavy cloth over her head that made breathing difficult. Her wrists were locked behind her, and her hands and arms ached from being twisted like a pretzel. Her ankles, too, were stuck together. She was lying on a quilt. She could feel what seemed to be leather behind her, like a sofa. The air was warm, even smoky. She was alive, at least for now. As her head slowly cleared, and she put together two thoughts, she became aware of the soft popping noises of a fire. A man coughed not far away. She dared not move, but her shoulders were screaming and she couldn't help but squirm. "It's probably time for you to come around," he said. The voice was familiar. She jerked and struggled and managed to sit up. "My arms are killing me," she said. "Who are you?" "I think you know." The sudden movement made her nauseous and she was afraid she would vomit. "I'm sick," she mumbled as acid filled her mouth. "Lean forward and puke all you want.